Well, I'm Dr. Cook, and this is Physics Part 3, sometimes called Further Physics, and we need to get on with it. But first of all, a warning. Part 3 is only taken by people who are doing single GCSE physics, and so it's harder. Part 2 was taken by people who were doing double science, which is the vast majority of people in UK schools. Part 3, although it's now officially available in all UK schools, is generally only done by people who've chosen physics and who are at good schools who have the ability to offer physics. That means that the final exam is going to be tougher. AQA know who's taking this exam, they know it's the brighter people, and therefore they design the exam that way. So even if you did absolutely brilliantly at parts 1 and 2, you're running on an A star and you didn't find them very hard, don't imagine it's going to be quite that way for part 3.
You're listening to VCJ, Victoria College, Jersey.
Now, I've had complaints about the light jazz, and as I've said to lots of people who've made those complaints, find me some copyright material music that's better than the light jazz, and I'll play that instead. No one has. Mr. Burby, it's your fault that we're playing this light jazz because you didn't bother finding me any copyright-free material that wasn't light jazz. Okay, so what's in part three? Well, part three consists of turning forces. That's moment, center of mass, stability, and that's where we'll go to begin with. There's then light and sound, how to draw ray diagrams, and how sound behaves, particularly how ultrasound is used. And finally, the motor effect, the electromagnetic induction effect, and the transformer effect. Those three effects. And then they're just tacked on the end. It doesn't really seem to match up with anything else in this part. There's a bit of stuff about how elements are formed within stars and the life cycle of stars. So what are we going to start with? We are going to start with turning forces. But first of all, I need to get my breath back, so I'm going to put a bit more of that on. Turning forces. The action of a force around a pivot. Now, if you've ever used a spanner, you ought to know, you ought to realise that the further you put your hand down the spanner, the easier it is to turn it. That's because the application of moments means that you get more torque. Torque is the word for a turning force. You get more torque if not only you increase the force being applied, but you actually increase the distance from the pivot that force is being applied at. And it's moments is the calculations that we do that allow us to work all of that out and to apply all of that. Now, a moment is the force being applied around the pivot multiplied by the perpendicular distance to that pivot. Okay, so I'll say that again. You need to get that in your head. A moment is the force being applied around a pivot multiplied by the perpendicular distance to that pivot. And what do I mean by perpendicular distance? I mean the distance at 90 degrees to the direction of the force. Sometimes that's a little bit difficult to visualise. And this whole part three is a bit more visual than parts one and two. So I've therefore done a PDF file to go with it to have some pictures in it to illustrate it all for you. So if you are struggling with this, if you need to have a look at some pictures, then download that PDF file and have it open at the same time. And I've illustrated some ideas of perpendicular distance when we're talking about moments in figure one on that PDF. We did this as a year seven experiment. As a year seven experiment, we set up a seesaw. We hung different masses on either side and found that by changing the distance from the masses from the pivot, you could make unequal masses balance on a seesaw. And we worked out why. We established the law of moments, and the law of moments says that for something to be in balance, the moments acting in a clockwise direction around a pivot, so whatever forces are tending to turn it clockwise, must be equal to the moments acting in an anti-clockwise direction around a pivot. So to work out whether something's going to be in balance or not, all you need to do is you need to say perpendicular distance multiplied by the force for each force acting to turn it clockwise, added together, must equal the perpendicular distance multiplied by the force for each force that's tending to turn it anti-clockwise, again added together. So the sum of the perpendicular distances multiplied by the forces clockwise must equal the sum of the perpendicular forces multiplied, sorry, the perpendicular distances multiplied by the forces acting anti-clockwise. I don't know whether that made any sense. Moments clockwise must equal moments anti-clockwise. And like I say, we did it in year 7. We hung a seesaw up and we made you hang the weights on and we made you move them around. It's a pretty standard first year 7 experiment, and hopefully you will remember it. But you probably don't. If you could remember things, you wouldn't be using this ear podcast, could you? Anyway, moments. How do we use moments? Well, quite often with moments, you'll be given a force and a distance on one side of the pivot. You'll be given a distance on the second side of the pivot, and you'll be asked to work out what the force is. And it's simply a matter of using the law of moments. You simply say force times the distance on the anti-clockwise side must equal the force times the distance on the clockwise side. Therefore, there's four things in your equation. One of them's missing. You rearrange the equation using the other three to give you the missing one. And generally, if it's that simple, all you've got to do is you multiply together the two you know on the anti-clockwise side, and you divide them by the one you know on the clockwise side, and that leaves you an answer, which is the one you didn't know on the clockwise side. I hope that makes some sense. Think it through. Write it down on a bit of paper and actually have a look at the maths involved. It's actually pretty simple rearranging. They hide the fact that it's simple rearranging sometimes with quite hard diagrams, where it's not obvious what the perpendicular distance involved is. But this being AQA, you don't actually get asked to do a whole lot of maths on it. You tend to get asked to look at a diagram and discuss the moments. So discuss how the moments change as something within that diagram changes. And generally what's going to change? Well, what's going to change is the perpendicular distance. So you've got to work out where that perpendicular distance is on the diagram and then discuss the change in moments, either increasing as the distance increases or decreasing as the distance decreases, as whatever changes on the diagram. So it's usually a very simple question hidden in a relatively difficult diagram. We've done some examples of that. We've had a look at some problems with that. So you ought to be able to get your head around the kind of diagrams that might be involved and get your head around answering that. And then it's just a matter of talking it through. Moments goes up because the distance is going up. So straightforward stuff. Hopefully not too hard. There's not a big section on it in the book because there's not a whole huge amount of it turns up in the exam. But it can turn up in the exam. The other thing that can turn up in the exam is a mark for the units of moments, because it's not something we've done before. And AQA have this policy that they'll give you units marks for units that you haven't come across before. So this is a new set of units. There's a good chance there'll be a units mark for it. And what are the units? Well, what have you done? Hopefully you remember. What have you done? You multiply force times a distance. What do you measure force in? Well, obviously you measure force in newtons. If you haven't remembered that, well, for goodness sake, what are you doing? Go and do biology. And what do you measure distance in? Well, you can measure distance in lots of things, of course. But there's only one thing that you're really allowed to measure distance in as far as physics is concerned, and that's meters. So when you are working out moments, you multiply the force in newtons by the distance in meters. And if you have to convert the distance into meters, do so. And then the units are obviously going to be newton meters. N, capital N, small m. Because you'll remember from your maths that if there's nothing between two things, if there's no symbol between them, then that means that we've multiplied them together. And we have indeed multiplied newtons by meters. Newton meters, NM. Okay? Probably going to be a mark for that. If newtons turns up in the exam, there's probably going to be a mark for writing those units down. So make sure you write those units down. Capital N, small m. Get the capitalization wrong and you are not going to get the marks. I've rather rushed through moments there, but it's actually not going to be a big part of your exam. Probably not going to involve much of a calculation other than working out what the moments on one side is. It's a much bigger chunk of the A-level, but actually the maths and what's involved in doing it at the A-level is no harder than it is at the GCSE. It's just that they get more questions on it than you guys do. All you got to do, perpendicular distance, and the perpendicular distance bit is the key. It's got to be perpendicular. Remember to have we've had a look at those diagrams, go back over some of the diagrams, work out what the perpendicular distance is. Not just the distance from where the force is acting, the perpendicular distance. And if you have to extend the line of force so that you can achieve draw on a perpendicular distance, do so. Don't forget that the diagrams on the exam paper are yours to scribble on, and AQA will award workings marks for illustrations for workings shown on the diagram. So dot those lines of force further down and show the perpendicular distances on those diagrams. Show that you're thinking it through, and even if you don't get your description spot on, you'll get some marks for the way you've done it on the diagram. Okay, centre of mass. Centre of mass, centre of gravity, essentially the same things. But AQA call it the centre of mass. And AQA specification says, the centre of mass of a body is that point at which the mass of the body may be thought of as concentrated. Okay, and we'll do that again, because sometimes you're asked to quote it. The centre of mass of a body is that point at which the mass of the body may be thought to be concentrated. The key bit in there is thought. It's not actually concentrated at the centre of mass. The centre of mass allows you to do is it allows you to treat a big uneven mass as all acting at one tiny point. So we could say it was infinitely dense, all the mass of that lump concentrated down into that tiny point, and it's all acting there. Thought to be concentrated. Don't leave the thought out when you write that up, please. It's not actually concentrated there. Well, what do we need to know about centre of mass? Well, you need to be able to describe how to find it. We did that experiment. I'm sure you've all done that experiment. How do you find it? If suspended, a body will come to rest with its centre of mass directly below the point of suspension. So what do? You suspend it from more than one point. You use a plumb line to mark on a vertical line. And the centre of mass must be somewhere along each vertical line. And therefore, if you hang it from different points, the centre of mass must be where those plumb lines cross. Okay? Centre of mass for a symmetrical body is along the axis of symmetry. Well, hopefully that's self-evident and you can all work that out for yourselves. So, centre of mass, just be able to describe that experiment, suspending it from different points, using a plumb line, marking on vertical lines, doing it in a couple of different places, where the vertical lines cross, that must be where the centre of mass is, because the centre of mass has to be somewhere along that plumb line, because of the rule I've just said, if suspended, a body will come to rest with its centre of mass directly below the point of suspension. Get all that? Cool. Centre of mass. Easy peasy. Just learn that experiment. It's described on page 217 of the textbook, if you can't remember it. All right, I've talked about moments in balance. There are some different diagrams of the forces and the direction the forces are acting at on page 219. So maybe you have a look at those. And we move on to stability. Stability, pretty easy. Hopefully it's pretty easy anyway.
You're listening to VCJ, Victoria College, Jersey.
I only put that in so I could get my breath back. All you've got to do, understand with stability is that something will be stable, i.e. it will fall back into the upright position, providing its centre of mass does not move outside of the base. So if you draw a vertical line down from the centre of mass, that vertical line mustn't come past the corners of the base. If it does come past the corners of the base, then the object will topple. Work it out for yourselves. Get yourself a board, put a square block on it, and try tipping the block up, see where it falls over. It falls when the vertical line, imaginary vertical line, from the centre of mass of the object comes outside the base. Therefore, how do you increase the stability of an object? Well, you increase the stability of an object in one of two ways. You either widen the base or you lower the centre of mass. So we looked in a lesson at a traffic cone. Traffic cones have very wide bases, and all of the mass of a traffic cone is in that base. So the center of mass is very low, very wide base, very low center of mass. So although it's quite a tall thing, it's extraordinarily difficult to knock over. It's been made stable by having a wide base and a low center of mass. Nothing terribly hard about that, but they do ask questions about it in the exam, so it's a useful one to get your head around. On page 221, they actually show bowling pins. Now, of course, bowling pins are designed to have a relatively narrow base and quite a high center of mass because they want you to be able to knock the bowling pins over. Bowling pins all have to have a particular shape, so the center of mass is at a particular point within them, so that they all fall the same way, no matter what bowling alley you happen to be operating on. Okay, that's the easy stuff as far as I'm concerned on this thing. We now come on to the conceptually harder, although they don't actually ask you to do any maths on it, part of it, which is circular motion.